men and gathered supplies. Word came downriver that the Sioux had joined the Arikaras and were determined to stop all boats headed upstream. Lewis looked over the supply of presents for the Indians and decided it was insufficient. So on March 7th, he signed a draft payable to Pierre Chouteau for $1,500 for additional presents. On May 13th, he signed another for $500, and 2 days later yet another in the amount of $450, mainly for 500 pounds of gunpowder and 1,250 pounds of lead. Meanwhile, he worked on a set of orders for Chouteau. He declared that Chouteau's principal object was to return Big White and his family. Paraphrasing what Jefferson had told him, Lewis wrote, "I consider the honor and good faith of our government pledged for the success of this enterprise." Lewis avoided specifics. "I deem it improper to trammel your operations by detailed and positive commands as to the plan of procedure." But he had suggestions. The first was to employ up to 300 Indians from the nations living below the Arikaras. "You will promise them, as a reward for their services, the plunder which they may acquire from the Arikaras." He further advised Chouteau to recruit 100 white hunters and trappers, bringing his total up to 250 whites and 300 Indians. In other words, should the Arikaras prove still to be hostile, Lewis was declaring all-out war on them. He was explicit on the point. He wanted Chouteau to have a force sufficient not only to bid defiance to the Arikaras, but to extirpate that abandoned nation if necessary. This went far beyond Jefferson's recommendation that if the Arikaras tried to stop Big White, they should be punished. It went far beyond burning their property or killing their horses. It called for nothing short of genocide. If the Arikaras proved to be peaceable, Chouteau should demand of them the unconditional surrender of the warriors who had killed any member of Ensign Pryor's party. Should the Arikaras claim they could not say who had fired the fatal bullets, Chouteau should require them to deliver up three warriors, three white men had been killed, chosen from among those most active in stimulating the hostilities. "These murderers, when delivered, will be shot in the presence of the nation," and the Arikaras required to give their horses to Chouteau's Indian allies. If the Arikaras refused to deliver up their warriors, "You will take such measures as you may think best calculated to surprise and cut them off." If Chouteau took any prisoners, "You will either give them to the Mandan or Minotaur nations." If the expeditions got into an inconclusive fight and passed the Arikaras without destroying them, Chouteau should make an alliance with the Mandans and supply them with the necessary firepower to crush the Arikaras. Lewis also said that Chouteau would be meeting with sundry American citizens whose licenses to trade on the Missouri had expired. If they had acted in good faith, Chouteau should renew their licenses. Had their conduct been improper, he should arrest them and return them to St. Louis by force. As for the competition from the North, "No British agent, clerk, or engagé can under any pretense whatever be permitted to trade or hunt within this territory, the limits of which are to be conceived to extend to all that country watered by the Missouri." Lewis signed off, "I sincerely wish you a pleasant voyage and a safe return to your family and friends." In mid-May, the expedition was underway. Altogether, there were 13 keelboats and barges, the largest flotilla sent up the river to date. Through June and into July, rumors floated around St. Louis about Bates. He had made it known that he intended to denounce Lewis to the president and was said to be at the head of a party whose object it would be to procure his dismissal. So widespread was the talk that Lewis called on Bates to demand an explanation. "You are greatly mistaken," Bates told him. In a letter of July 14th to his brother, Bates related that, "As a citizen, I told him I entertained opinions very different from his on the subject of civil government, and that those opinions had, on various occasions, been expressed with emphasis, but that they had been unmixed with personal malice or hostility." "Well," Lewis replied, "do not suffer yourself to be separated from me in the public opinion. When we meet in public, let us at least address each other with cordiality." Bates agreed, though he complained to his brother that Lewis had used me badly. Then Bates demanded that Clark be brought into the conversation to settle the business about Lewis's appointment of Clark as his agent. When Clark arrived, Bates told the two men that the laws expressly provided that he, Secretary Bates, should be the governor's agent when the governor was traveling. "I will suffer no interferences, etc., etc., etc.," he declared. To his brother, Bates remarked, "How unfortunate for this man, Lewis, that he resigned his commission in the army. His habits are altogether military, and he never can, I think, succeed in any other profession." On July 16th, Bates wrote the Secretary of the Treasury to complain about Lewis's behavior. It seemed Lewis had ordered Bates to print the laws of the territory and charge it to the Secretary's office. Bates had refused, but ultimately relented in response to Lewis's repeated order. Now he wanted the Treasury to compensate him. By July 25th, Bates was able to boast to an ally, "Our Governor Lewis, with the best intentions in the world, is, I am fearful, losing ground. He has talked for these 12 months of leaving the country. Everybody thinks now that he will positively go in a few weeks." In early August, Lewis received a short note from a clerk in the Department of State named R.S. Smith. It referred to a draft Lewis had signed on February 10th in favor of one Peter Provencher for $18.50 for translating the laws of the territory into French for publication. Although Lewis had no authorization to pay for such services, he explained, "I did not hesitate to cause the copies of those laws to be made out for a felony trial. I was compelled to take the course which I have, or suffer a fellow to escape punishment." Now the bill came back to him with a note from Clerk Smith. "The bill mentioned in this letter, having been drawn without authority, it cannot be paid at this department." Lewis was shaken by the refusal. "This occurrence has given me infinite concern, as from it the fate of other bills, drawn for similar purposes, to a considerable amount, cannot be mistaken," he wrote. "This rejection cannot fail to impress the public mind unfavorably with respect to me, nor is this consideration more painful than the censure which must arise in the mind of the executive from my having drawn public monies without authority. A third and not less embarrassing circumstance attending the transaction is that my private funds are entirely incompetent to meet these bills, if protested." Secretary Bates thought of himself as a long-suffering, honest, misunderstood man guarding the public treasury. He sent a series of complaints about Lewis's drafts and orders to Washington. Sometime that summer, Lewis struck back. As Bates put it, "He took it into his head to disavow certain statements which I had made, by his order, from the Secretary's office. This was too much. I waited on him, told him my wrongs, that I could not bear to be treated in such a manner." "Take your own course," Lewis replied. "I shall, sir," Bates fired back. "And I shall come in future to the executive office when I have business at it." Shortly thereafter, a ball was held in St. Louis. Bates was present when Lewis entered. Bates recorded, "He drew his chair close to mine. There was a pause in the conversation. I availed myself of it, arose, and walked to the opposite side of the room." Lewis also rose, according to Bates, evidently in passion. Lewis retired into an adjoining room and sent a servant for Clark. He told Clark that Bates had treated him with contempt and insult and that he could not suffer it to pass. He asked him to call Bates into the room. Clark refused, according to Bates, because he foresaw that a battle must have been the consequence of our meeting. Some days later, Clark called on Bates to ask that he patch things up with Lewis. "No," Bates replied. "The governor has told me to take my own course, and I shall step a high and a proud path. He has injured me, and he must undo that injury." "You come," Bates told Clark, "as my friend, but I cannot separate you from Governor Lewis. You have trodden the ups and the downs of life with him, and it appears to me that these proposals are made solely for his convenience." This unseemly squabbling certainly did Lewis's mood no good, but it was a minor affair compared with what happened to him on August 18th. That day, he received a heart-stopping letter from Secretary of War Eustace. Dated July 19th, it was written in the deadly passive voice of the born bureaucrat. Eustace said that, after his department had reluctantly approved Lewis's contract with the Missouri River Fur Company for $7,000, It was not expected that any further advances or any further agency would be required on the part of the United States. Lewis should, therefore, not be surprised that his draft of May 13th for an additional $500 for presents for the Indians has not been honored. That meant Lewis was personally responsible for the money. Eustace went on, "It has been usual to advise the government of the United States when expenditures to a considerable amount are contemplated in the territorial government. When 125 men are to be enlisted for a military expedition to a point and purpose not designated, which expedition is stated to combine commercial as well as military objects, it is thought the government might, without injury to the public interests, have been consulted." In fact, Lewis had been explicit about the purpose of the expedition, although he had not cleared the commercial aspects of it with Washington. Eustace seized on that point. "As the object and destination of this force, beyond the Mandans, is unknown, and more especially as it combines commercial purposes, so it cannot be considered as having the sanction of the government of the United States, or that they are responsible for consequences." Eustace closed with a chilling remark. "The President has been consulted, and the observations herein contained have his approval." The President, of course, was Madison, not Jefferson, now retired at Monticello and unable to protect Lewis. In any event, Jefferson was unhappy with Lewis. He was slow to censure and ready to give Lewis the benefit of the doubt, but his patience was wearing thin. On August 16th, he sent Lewis a letter of introduction for an English botanist coming to St. Louis on a botanizing tour. Then Jefferson wrote, "I am very often applied to know when your work will begin to appear, and I have so long promised copies to my literary correspondents in France that I am almost bankrupt in their eyes. I shall be very happy to receive from yourself information of your expectations on this subject. Everybody is impatient for it." Perhaps to soften the blow, Jefferson added some political gossip and commentary on foreign affairs. He said Lewis's friends in Virginia are well and have been long in expectation of seeing you. I shall hope in that case to possess a due portion of you at Monticello, where I am at length enjoying the never-before-known luxury of employing myself for my own gratification only. He asked Lewis to present his best wishes to Clark, "and be assured yourself of my constant and unalterable affections." Lewis never replied or made any known mention of the letter, nor did he explain to anyone, even Clark, the cause of the delay in preparing the journals for publication. Lewis did reply to Eustace in a letter of August 18th, the day he got it. He said Eustace's letter of July 19th is now before me. The feelings it excites are truly painful. He protested that he had accompanied every draft for a public expenditure with an explicit statement of the purpose and insisted, "I have never received a penny of public money." He added, "To the correctness of this statement, I call my God to witness. I have been informed representations have been made against me," Lewis went on. What those representations might have been is not known, but can be surmised from his protests against them. Nor is the source known, but it can be guessed that it was Bates. Evidently, Bates, or someone else, had spread a story that the Missouri River Fur Company intended to go into the Rocky Mountains, beyond the Continental Divide, into territory not belonging to the United States, possibly with the intent of setting up a new country, a la Aaron Burr and General Wilkinson. Whatever the specifics, Lewis said he could not correct by letter the impressions which I fear from the tenor of your letter the government entertain with respect to me. Therefore, he would leave St. Louis in a week, going by way of New Orleans to Washington. "I shall take with me my papers, which I trust, when examined, will prove my firm and steady attachment to my country." The expedition to return Big White had only that object, he went on, "and in a commercial point of view, they, the company, intend only to hunt and trade on the waters of the Missouri and Columbia rivers within the Rocky Mountains and the plains bordering those mountains on the east side, and that they have no intention with which I am acquainted to enter the dominions or do injury to any foreign power. Be assured, sir, that my country can never make a burr of me. She may reduce me to poverty, but she can never sever my attachment from her." Word that the government had refused to honor Lewis's drafts had spread round town within hours of the arrival of Eustace's letter. Bates again. Lewis informed Eustace that the protested bills have effectually sunk my credit, brought in all my private debts amounting to about $4,000. He had handed over to his creditors the deeds to the land he had purchased around St. Louis as security, and pointed out that the best proof which I can give of my integrity as to the use or expenditure of the public monies, the government will find at a future day by the poverty to which they have now reduced me. Lewis spent the next few days with Clark. They agreed that both of them should go to Washington. Clark was, of course, deeply involved in the Missouri River Fur Company, and in any case had other governmental matters to take up with the War Department, including protested drafts of his brother George Rogers Clark, which had ruined him. Lewis would go by water, Clark over land. They spent much time attempting to put Lewis's accounts in order. They made up a list of what Lewis owed. It came to some $2,900, exclusive of his land debts. Lewis sent ahead to New Orleans the land warrant for 1,600 acres he had been given by Congress, to be sold, he hoped, for $2 an acre. He wanted the money deposited in a New Orleans bank, for the benefit of my creditors. He returned to Auguste Chouteau much of the land he had bought from him on credit. He looked around for anything he had that could be sold. In Clark's memorandum book, Lewis wrote, "The Negro boy Tom belongs to my mother, and therefore cannot be sold on my account." The most valuable item he possessed, by far, was the journals, worth 1,000 times and more what the land warrant would bring. Those he would never sell. Lewis had told Eustace that he would be departing in a week, but it actually took him 3 weeks to get going. He packed all his belongings, including the journals, which had been continuously in his possession since the end of the expedition. He told Clark he would go to Philadelphia to get the publication process started. His baggage contained, among many other items, a sea otter skin, a pair of red slippers, a silver tumbler, a tomahawk, 5 vests, 2 pairs of pantaloons, 1 pair of black silk breeches, 2 cotton shirts, 1 flannel shirt, 2 pairs of cotton stockings, 3 pairs of silk stockings, a bundle of medicines, a broadcloth coat, a pistol case, 3 knives, a sword, a pike blade with a broken shaft, his espontoon, and all his official papers. He got off on September 4th. Some days after Lewis left St. Louis, one of the land commissioners in the territory, Clement Penrose, accused Bates of being responsible for the mental derangement of the governor, which Penrose said was due to the barbarous conduct of the secretary. Bates confronted Penrose after a meeting of the Board of Commissioners. He charged Penrose with spreading slanders against him and said, "I pledge my word of honor that if you ever again bark at my heels, I will spurn you like a puppy." Later that day, he wrote Penrose a record of the conversation. "You said that I have been and am the enemy of the governor, and that I would be very willing to fill that office myself. I told you this morning that it was false, and I repeat that it is an impudent stupidity in you to persist in the assertion. In return for the personal allusions with which you have honored me, I tender to you my most hearty contempt." In another letter that week, Bates wrote that, "All feeling minds are, in different degrees, affected by the unhappy situation of Governor Lewis, and would feel a painful reluctance in contributing to his mortifications." Lewis had borrowed again enough money to purchase a considerable medical chest. He jotted in his account book that he had bought pills for bilious fever, pills of opium and tartar, and others. The Missouri Gazette had reported that Governor Lewis set off in good health for New Orleans on his way to the federal city. The emphasis on his health had more an ominous than a reassuring ring. The day after Lewis's departure, Clark wrote his brother Jonathan, describing Lewis's situation and mood during his last week in St. Louis. "Governor L., I may say, is ruined by some of his bills being protested for a considerable sum, which was for monies paid for printing the laws and expenses in carrying the Mandan home, all of which he has vouchers for. I have not spent such a day as yesterday for many years. I took my leave of Governor Lewis, who set out to Philadelphia to write our book, but more particularly to explain some matter between him and the government. Several of his bills have been protested, and his creditors, all flocking in near the time of his setting out, distressed him much, which he expressed to me in such terms as to cause a sympathy which is not yet off. I do not believe there was ever an honester man in Louisiana, nor one who had purer motives than Governor Lewis. If his mind had been at ease, I should have parted cheerfully. I think all will be right, and he will return with flying colors to this country. Pray do not mention this about the governor except some unfavorable or wrong statement is made. I assure you that he has done nothing dishonorable, and all he has done will come out to be much to his credit, as I am fully persuaded. Chapter 37. Last Voyage. September 3rd to October 11th, 1809. The Mississippi River Valley in early September 1809 was hot, humid, buggy. Lewis's boat proceeded slowly since it was necessary for the crew to rest during the middle part of the day. He was in terrible condition, possibly suffering from a malaria attack, certainly in a deep depression that caused him unbearable pain. Twice he tried to kill himself, whether by jumping overboard or with his pistol is not known, and had to be restrained by the crew. On September 11th, he wrote his last will and testament. I bequeath all my estate, real and personal, to my mother, Lucy Marks, after my private debts are paid, of which a statement will be found in a small, minute book deposited with Pernia, my servant. Lewis arrived at Chickasaw Bluffs, then the site of Fort Pickering, today the site of Memphis, Tennessee, on September 15th. Captain Gilbert Russell was the commander at the fort. On being informed of Lewis's suicide attempts, he resolved at once to take possession of him and his papers and detain them there until he recovered, or some friend might arrive in whose hands he could depart in safety. Lewis was drinking heavily, using snuff frequently, taking his pills, talking wildly, telling lies. He told Russell, as reported in the November 15, 1809 Washington Advertiser, that all the work on the journals had been completed and they were ready for the press. Apparently, that was his way of deflecting embarrassing questions about the project's progress. Russell deprived him of liquor, allowing him only claret and a little white wine. The day after his arrival, Lewis wrote President Madison. The letter was garbled, although he managed to make his point. It needs to be quoted in full. I arrived here yesterday about 2 o'clock p.m., very much exhausted from the heat of the climate, but having taken medicine, feel much better this morning. My apprehension for the heat of the lower country and my fear of the original papers relative to my voyage to the Pacific Ocean falling into the hands of the British has induced me to change my route and proceed by land through the state of Tennessee to the city of Washington. I bring with me duplicates of my vouchers for public expenditures, etc., which, when fully explained, or rather the general view of the circumstances under which they were made, I flatter myself that they will receive both approbation and sanction. Provided my health permits, no time shall be lost in reaching Washington. My anxiety to pursue and to fulfill the duties incident to the internal arrangements incident to the government of Louisiana has prevented my writing you more frequently. Mr. Bates is left in charge. Enclosed, I herewith transmit you a copy of the laws of the Territory of Louisiana. I have the honor to be, with the most sincere esteem, your obedient and very humble servant. Over the following 5 days, Lewis showed no sign of improvement. Russell apparently had not deprived him of his medicines. Russell maintained a 24-hour suicide watch. Finally, Russell reported, "On the sixth or seventh day, all symptoms of derangement disappeared and he was completely in his senses, although he was considerably reduced and debilitated." He was also ashamed of himself. Russell reported that, "He acknowledged very candidly to me after his recovery that he had been drinking to excess." Lewis said he was resolved never to drink any more spirits or use snuff again. Lewis set about straightening out his affairs. On September 22nd, he wrote his old friend Major Amos Stoddard, in command at Fort Adams, farther down the river. He began with an apology. I must acknowledge myself remiss in not writing you in answer to several friendly epistles which I have received from you since my return from the Pacific Ocean. He said he was on his way to Washington to explain his actions in St. Louis, which he hoped is all that is necessary to put all matters right. But his creditors were pressing him and had excessively embarrassed me. I hope you will therefore pardon me for asking you to remit as soon as is convenient the sum of $200 which you have informed me you hold for me. You will direct to me at the city of Washington until the last of December, after which I expect I shall be on my return to St. Louis. Lewis asked Russell to accompany him to Washington, and Russell agreed. He too had some protested bills to explain to the new administration. But he could not get the leave of absence he had requested. Major James Neely, the U.S. agent to the Chickasaw Nation, had arrived at Fort Pickering on September 18th. He later wrote Jefferson that he found the governor in very bad health, but that during the week Lewis recovered his health in some degree. By September 29th, Russell and Neely were satisfied that Lewis was capable of traveling overland to Washington, if accompanied by Neely, Pernier, and Neely's servant. Lewis said he was ready to make the journey. Russell lent him $100 and sold him 2 horses on credit for the journey. Lewis signed a promissory note for $379.58, payable before January 1, 1810, for the loan and the horses. Lewis had with him the journals, packed in trunks and carried by packhorse. The Natchez Trace seemed much safer to him than risking a sailboat from New Orleans to Washington, with British warships prowling the Atlantic coast, stopping American vessels, and impressing American seamen into British service. What the British would give to have those journals! There was no danger of that on the Trace, which was the most heavily traveled road of the Old Southwest. The mail passed over it regularly. No robbery had been reported for years. There were inns along the way. It took the party 3 days to cover 100 miles. Along the way, Lewis repeatedly complained about his protested drafts. Pernier later reported to Clark that Lewis would frequently conceive that he heard me, Clark, coming on, and said that he was certain I would overtake him, that I had heard of his situation and would come to his relief. Lewis was drinking again, or, as Russell so heartbreakingly put it, his resolution never to drink again left him. Neely later reported to Jefferson that when they arrived at the Chickasaw Agency, some 6 miles north of present Houston, Mississippi, Lewis appeared at times deranged in mind. At Neely's insistence, the party stayed 2 days at the agency to rest. Lewis asked Neely, in the event that any accident happened to him, to send his trunks with the journals to the president, by whom Neely assumed Lewis meant Jefferson, not Madison. On October 6th, Lewis, Neely, and the servants set out again. On the morning of October 9th, they crossed the Tennessee River and camped near the present village of Collinwood, Tennessee. That night, 2 of the horses strayed. In the morning, Neely said he would stay behind to find them. Lewis decided to proceed, Neely reported, with a promise to wait for me at the first house he came to that was inhabited by white people. Late in the afternoon, Lewis arrived at Grinder's Inn, 72 miles short of Nashville. It was a rough-hewn, poorly built log cabin that took in overnight customers. Mr. Grinder was away. Lewis requested accommodations for the night. "Are you alone?" Mrs. Grinder asked. "No," Lewis replied. "Two servants would be coming on shortly." Mrs. Grinder said they were welcome. Lewis dismounted, unsaddled his horse, and brought the saddle in the house. He was dressed in a loose gown, white, striped with blue. He asked for some whiskey, of which he drank but a little. When Pernier and the other servant arrived, Lewis asked for his gunpowder, saying he was sure he had some in a canister. Pernier gave no distinct reply, probably because he had been told by Neely to keep the powder away from Lewis. Lewis began pacing in front of the cabin. Mrs. Grinder later reported that sometimes he would seem as if he were walking up to her, and would suddenly wheel round and walk back as fast as he could. She prepared a meal. Lewis entered the cabin and sat at the table, but after only a few mouthfuls he started up, speaking to himself in a violent manner. Mrs. Grinder noted that his face was flushed, as if it had come on him in a fit. Lewis lit his pipe, drew a chair to the door, sat down, and remarked to Mrs. Grinder in a kindly tone, "Madam, this is a very pleasant evening." After finishing the pipe, he rose and paced the yard. He sat again, lit another pipe, seemed composed. He cast his eyes wishfully towards the west. He spoke again of what a sweet evening it was. As he sat on Mrs. Grinder's porch, looking west while the light faded from the sky, what were his thoughts? Were they of the rivers, the Missouri and the Columbia and the others? Did he recall the Arikaras, the Sioux, the Mandans? Did he think of the first time he had seen Sacajawea? Did he remember the April day in 1805 when he started out from the Mandan Nation on his darling project, daring to link his name with Columbus and Captain Cook? Did he dwell on the decision at the Marias? Or were the plants, animals, birds, scenery of the Garden of Eden he had passed through commanding his imagination? If so, surely he thought of cottonwoods, prickly pears, the gigantic trees of the Pacific coast, of grouse and woodpeckers and condors, of the grizzlies and the unbelievable buffalo herds, the pronghorns, sheep, coyotes, prairie dogs, and the other animals he had discovered and described, of those remarkable white cliffs along the Missouri, the gates of the Rocky Mountains, the Columbia Gorge. Did Three Forks, that essential spot in the geography of the West, spring to his mind? Or was it Kamiyawet and the Shoshones? Perhaps it was old Toby and that terrible trip across the Bitterroots. Did he recall the Nez Perce and their fabulous ponies and generosity? Or the journey down the western waters to the sea? Or was it his Christmas and New Year's dinners of water and lean elk at Fort Clatsop? It may be that he thought of the long waiting period with the Nez Perce, and the one time he had been forced to turn back in the first attempt to force the Bitterroots in the spring of 1806. Or was it the Blackfeet and the only Indian fight of his life? Or the time he got shot in the ass? Did he do a roll call of his men? If so, surely there was a special place for Driar. If he thought of the men, surely he thought of his co-commander, the best friend any man ever had. He had told Pernier earlier that day that General Clark had heard of his difficulties and was coming on. As the light faded, was he looking westward along the trace, expecting to see Clark ride in to set everything right? Did one of Mrs. Grinder's dogs chase a squirrel and remind him of seamen? Could it be that he thought of that moment of triumph when his canoes put in at St. Louis in September 1806? Or were his thoughts gloomy? Were they about his unsolvable problems? Did he agonize over his speculations and the financial ruin they had brought him? Was that awful Secretary Bates foremost in his thoughts? Did he wonder why he had failed in his courtships and had no wife? Did he curse himself for his drinking? Did his mind dwell on Thomas Jefferson? Was he ashamed of how he had failed the man he adored? Did he think of the journals over in the corner in his saddlebags? Or did his mind avoid the past? Was he rehearsing what he would say to Secretary Eustace and President Madison? Or was he yearning for more pills or more whiskey? We cannot know. We only know that he was tortured, that his pain was unbearable. Mrs. Grinder began to prepare a bed for him, but he stopped her and said he would sleep on the floor, explaining that since his journey to the Pacific he could no longer sleep on a feather bed. He had Pernier bring in his bearskins and buffalo robe and spread them on the floor. While Pernier was getting the bedding, Lewis found some powder. Mrs. Grinder went to the kitchen to sleep, and the servants went to the barn, some 200 yards distant. Lewis began pacing in his room. This went on for several hours. Mrs. Grinder, who was frightened and could not sleep, heard him talking aloud, like a lawyer. Lewis got out his pistols. He loaded them, and at some time during the early hours of October 11th, shot himself in the head. The ball only grazed his skull. He fell heavily to the floor. Mrs. Grinder heard him exclaim, "Oh, Lord!" Lewis rose, took up his other pistol, and shot himself in his breast. The ball entered and passed downward through his body to emerge low down on his backbone. He survived the second shot, staggered to the door of his room, and called out, "Oh, madam, give me some water and heal my wounds." Lewis staggered outside, fell, crawled for some distance, raised himself by the side of a tree, then staggered back to his room. He scraped the bucket with a gourd for water, but the bucket was empty. He collapsed on his robes. At first light, the terrified Mrs. Grinder sent her children to fetch the servants. When they got to Lewis's room, they found him busily engaged in cutting himself from head to foot with his razor. Lewis saw Pernier and said to him, "I have done the business. My good servant, give me some water." Pernier did. Lewis uncovered his side and showed them the second wound. He said, "I am no coward, but I am so strong, it is so hard to die." He said he had tried to kill himself to deprive his enemies of the pleasure and honor of doing it. He begged the servants to take his rifle and blow out his brains, telling them not to be afraid, for he would not hurt them, and they could have all the money in his trunk. Shortly after sunrise, his great heart stopped beating. Chapter 38, The Last Chapter, Aftermath. On October 28th, Clark got the news of Lewis's suicide from the Frankfort, Kentucky Argus of Western America. He was in Shelbyville on his way to Washington. George Shannon was with him. Clark wrote his brother Jonathan, "I fear this report has too much truth. My reason for thinking it possible is found on the letter I received from him at your house. I fear, oh, I fear the weight of his mind has overcome him. What will be the consequence?" 2 days later, Clark wrote again to report he had heard of the certainty of the death of Governor Lewis, which gives us much uneasiness. "I wish much to get the letter I received of Governor Lewis from New Madrid, which you saw. It will be of great service to me. Pray send it. I wish I had some conversation with you." Lewis's letter to Clark, written around September 11th, the day Lewis wrote his will, has never been found. Jefferson got the news at Monticello in November, via either the newspapers or Neely's letter to him. Neely said he had arrived at Grinder's Inn on the morning of October 11th, after Lewis's death, and had buried him as decently as I could. He gave a brief account of the suicide and asked instructions on what to do with Lewis's trunks. A week or so later, Pernier visited Jefferson and gave him an eyewitness account of Lewis's last day on earth. Jefferson's first known written comment on Lewis's death is in a letter to Dr. William Dixon of Nashville, dated April 20, 1810. Dixon had sent on a miniature of Lewis and Lewis's watch chain, which had somehow come into his possession. In acknowledging their receipt, Jefferson said he was sending the items to Lewis's mother. "The deplorable accident which has placed her in the deepest affliction," he wrote, "is a great loss to the world also, as no pen can ever give us so faithful and lively an account of the countries and nations which he saw, as his own would have done, under the guidance of impressions made by the objects themselves." 8 days later, Jefferson wrote Captain Russell, his first known comment on the cause of the suicide. He said Lewis was much afflicted and habitually so with hypochondria. This was probably increased by the habit into which he had fallen and the painful reflections that would necessarily produce in a mind like his. Some 3 years later, in a short biography of Lewis, Jefferson went into more detail. "Governor Lewis had from early life been subject to hypochondriac affections. It was a constitutional disposition in all the nearer branches of the family of his name, and was more immediately inherited by him from his father. While he lived with me in Washington, I observed at times sensible depressions of mind, but knowing their constitutional source, I estimated their course by what I had seen in the family. During his Western expedition, the constant exertion which that required of all the faculties of body and mind suspended these distressing affections, but after his establishment at St. Louis in sedentary occupations, they returned upon him with redoubled vigor and began seriously to alarm his friends. At about 3 o'clock in the night of October 10th to 11th, he did the deed which plunged his friends into affliction and deprived his country of one of her most valued citizens." There is a considerable literature on the possibility that Lewis did not commit suicide but was murdered. The first to put forth that claim in any detail was Vardis Fisher. Dr. Chinar has more recently made the same assertion. The literature is not convincing. the detailed refutation by Paul Russell Cutright is. A suggestion has been made that Lewis's mental problems stemmed not from hypochondria, as Jefferson would have it, or a manic depressive syndrome, but from the effects of an advanced case of syphilis. It is more intriguing and speculative than convincing. What is convincing is the initial reaction of the two men who knew Lewis best and loved him most. William Clark and Thomas Jefferson immediately concluded that the story of Lewis's suicide was entirely believable. Clark, on the basis of his intimate knowledge of Lewis's mental state, and more explicitly on the never-found Lewis letter of mid-September. Neither Jefferson nor Clark ever doubted that Lewis killed himself. Those who still hold out for murder need to deal with a dog-that-did-not-bark aspect of the case. Had William Clark entertained the slightest suspicion that his friend had been murdered, can anyone doubt that he would have gone to Tennessee immediately to find and hang the murderer? Or, if Jefferson had such suspicions, that he would have insisted the government launch an investigation? Lewis's half-brother, John Marks, did an inventory of Lewis's debts and assets. He had private debts amounting to $4,196.12 and protested drafts totaling $6,956.62. His credits and estate were worth $5,700. He had a further credit of $754.50 for Indian presents and gunpowder sold by Chouteau after he returned from successfully getting Big White back to the Mandan Nation. It turned out that the presents and the gunpowder, which had been the cause of such distress to Lewis when the Madison administration refused to honor the draft used to pay for them, were not needed. Clark visited Washington in December 1809. He recorded in the journal he kept that on December 18th he went to see the Secretary of War, Eustis, had a long talk about Governor Lewis. He pointed out his intentions and views for the protests, declared the governor had not lost the confidence of the government. The statement was 2 months and 7 days too late. "I do not know what I shall do about the publication of the book," Clark wrote Jonathan. Clark was ignorant of what had been done to get a manuscript ready for the printer. In a memorandum he wrote to himself in late 1809, before going to Philadelphia to see what could be done about publication, he put down questions he needed to ask. "Inquire what has been done by Governor Lewis with calculations, engraving, printing, botany. If a man can be got to go to St. Louis with me to write the journal and price. The price of engraving animals, Indians, and maps, paper, and other expenses. Get someone to write the scientific part and natural history, botany, mineralogy, and zoology. Prairies, muddiness of the Missouri. Natural phenomena, 23 vocabularies and plates and engraving." Obviously, Clark had discussed none of this with Lewis, who had already taken care of and paid for some of the arrangements Clark thought he needed to make. Amazingly, Lewis had never talked to Clark about publication, except to promise one more time that when he got to Philadelphia, he would complete the task. This is the great mystery of Lewis's life. There is only speculation on what kept him from preparing the journals for the publisher, but no one can know the cause for certain, any more than anyone can know for certain the cause of his suicide. On learning of Lewis's suicide, the publishers, C. and A. Conrad of Philadelphia, told Jefferson that they had a contract to produce the journals and asked what they should do now. "Governor Lewis never furnished us with a line of the manuscript," they told Jefferson, "nor, indeed, could we ever hear anything from him respecting it, though frequent applications to that effect were made to him." Jefferson replied that the journals were coming to Monticello, and so was Clark, that they would consult, that Clark would come on to Philadelphia to see what could be done. When Clark arrived at Monticello, there was apparently some talk about Jefferson's taking over the journals and doing the editing to prepare them for the printer. There was no man alive who had a greater interest in the subject, or one who had better qualifications for the job. But he was 65 years old and desired to spend his remaining years at Monticello as a gentleman farmer. In January 1810, Lewis's cousin William Merriweather wrote Clark, "Mr. Jefferson would not undertake the work." Clark took the journals to Philadelphia, where he called on the men who had helped Lewis prepare for the expedition and those whom Lewis had hired to do drawings and calculations. Charles Wilson Peale was one of them. On February 3, 1810, Peale wrote his brother, "I would rather Clark had undertaken to have wrote the whole himself and then have put it into the hands of some person of talents to brush it up, but I found that the general was too diffident of his abilities." After some false starts, Clark persuaded Nicholas Biddle to undertake the work. Biddle was only 26 years old, but he was a prodigy. He had been granted admission to the University of Pennsylvania at the age of 10. After 3 years, he had completed the requirements, but the university, citing his extreme youth, denied him a diploma. He went to Princeton, from which he graduated in 1801 at the age of 15. After graduation, he studied law and wrote essays. He married one of the richest women in the country, so he had no money problems and lots of time. Biddle was the perfect choice. He threw himself into the work and did it magnificently. George Shannon helped him, as did Clark, and finally a young man named Paul Allen did some copy editing. For $500, Biddle took nothing for himself for more than 2 years of full-time labor. Nothing ever came easy for those star-crossed journals, however. Biddle had persuaded Dr. Barton to do the scientific volume, but Barton's health failed and he could not complete the job. And just when Biddle was ready to turn the narrative volume over to the printer, the War of 1812 began. Worse, the firm of C&A Conrad collapsed. As Biddle expressed his fear, "The work will lose some of its interest by so much delay." It took him more than a year to find a publisher, Bradford and Inskeep of Philadelphia. In 1814, the book appeared, titled The History of the Expedition Under the Commands of Captains Lewis and Clark. It was a narrative and paraphrase of the journals, completely true to the original, retaining some of the more delightful phrases but with the spelling corrected. Biddle did relatively little with the flora and fauna. Bradford and Inskeep printed 1,417 copies and priced them at $6. They sold slowly. There were already editions of Gass's journal in print, and many counterfeits. Biddle wanted the publisher to pay royalties to Clark, but he never received a penny. For the next 90 years, Biddle's edition was the only printed account based on the journals. As a result, Lewis and Clark got no credit for most of their discoveries. Plants, rivers, animals, birds that they had described and named were newly discovered by naturalists, and the names that these men gave them were the ones that stuck. Lewis had cheated himself out of a rank not far below Darwin as a naturalist. In 1893, the naturalist Elliot Coues published a reprint of the Biddle narrative. He added footnotes on many subjects, including material on birds, animals, and plants, and especially geography. In 1904, on the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the expedition, Reuben Gold Thwaites of the Wisconsin State Historical Society published Dodd Mead, The Complete Journals, in 8 volumes, including never-before-seen journals from 2 of the enlisted men. His editorial work was outstanding. Often reprinted, Thwaites, as the work is known among Lewis and Clark fans, is an American classic. In 1962, Donald Jackson edited the letters of the Lewis and Clark expedition. University of Illinois Press expanded to 2 volumes in 1978. Together with Jackson's notes, it is a work of scholarship almost unequaled anywhere, and certainly never surpassed. In the 1980s, Gary Moulton edited an 8-volume set of the Captain's Journals for the University of Nebraska Press. He added much new material, including Lewis's journal of his trip down the Ohio in 1803, previously published by Milo Quaife in 1916, and innumerable fascinating footnotes, with a special emphasis on botany and other scientific subjects. Moulton's edition is the definitive work for our time. But he himself points out, as did Jackson before him, that nothing is ever truly definitive in history. There are always new documents coming to light. Biddle, Thwaites, Jackson, and Moulton together make the rock on which all Lewis and Clark scholarship stands. Biddle's name appears nowhere in his narrative, apparently because he insisted on complete anonymity. On the title page, where his name should have appeared, it reads, "Prepared for the press by Paul Allen, Esquire." Allen can be forgiven, for it was he who induced Jefferson to write a memoir biography of Lewis. He wrote Jefferson, "I wish very much to enliven the dullness of the narrative by something more popular, splendid, and attractive." Elliot Coues commented that Allen's letter exhibited an achievement in impudence that deserves to become historical. Jefferson wrote a 5,000-word letter on Lewis's life in 1813. The first biography of Lewis, it was written with Jefferson's usual care for accuracy and detail. Jefferson never allowed his disappointment over his inability to send the scientific parts of the journals to his fellow members of the Enlightenment, both at home and abroad, or his heartbreak over Lewis's suicide, to sour him on his protégé. The expedition had not fulfilled his hopes in many ways, most of all in not discovering an all-water route to the Pacific, but he did not allow that disappointment to affect his judgment of Lewis. At the time Jefferson wrote his memoir of Lewis, the Louisiana Purchase did not look like such a great bargain. The Indians were up in arms, the St. Louis, Missouri River Fur Company and John Jacob Astor had failed to establish permanent posts in the West, the ultimate fate of the great Northwestern Empire was still to be determined, and the distances involved appeared to preclude any significant economic activity in Louisiana. Federalists such as John Quincy Adams continued to ridicule the purchase. Nevertheless, Jefferson knew what he had achieved. Dumas Malone says it perfectly. Jefferson's vision extended farther and comprehended more than that of anybody else in public life, and thinking of himself as working for posterity, he was more concerned that things should be well started than that they be quickly finished. In few things that he did as president was he more in character than as a patron of exploration, and he could well afford to leave his performance in that role to the judgment of posterity. One may doubt if any successor of his ever approached it. Lewis cut his life off at the midpoint. He never reached an age of maturity. Still, enough is known to allow some generalizations. He was a good man in a crisis. If I was ever in a desperate situation, caught in a grass fire on the prairie, or sinking in a small boat in a big ocean, or the like, then I would want Meriwether Lewis for my leader. I am as one with Private Windsor, who, when about to slip off the bluff over the Marias River, barely managing to hold on, badly frightened, called out, "Good God, Captain, what shall I do?" I, too, would instinctively trust Lewis to know what to do. He knew the wilderness as well as any American alive during his day, including Daniel Boone and William Clark, and was only surpassed later by John Coulter and a few other of the most famous mountain men. His intense curiosity about everything new he saw around him was infectious. Certainly he would be anyone's first choice for a companion on an extended camping trip. Imagine sitting around the campfire while he talked about what he had seen that day. He had a short temper and too often acted on it. His proclivity for beating Indians who displeased him, his readiness to burn their villages or even extirpate them, recalls to mind Jefferson's point that it would be a prodigy indeed who could grow up as a slave master and keep his humanity. Lewis could not keep his boisterous passions in check. He was a man of high energy and was at times impetuous, but this was tempered by his great self-discipline. He could drive himself to the point of exhaustion, then take an hour to write about the events of the day, and another to make his celestial observations. His talents and skills ran wider than they did deep. He knew how to do many things, from designing and building a boat to all the necessary wilderness skills. He knew a little about many of the various parts of the natural sciences. He could describe an animal, classify a plant, name the stars, manage the sextant and other instruments, dream of empire. But at none of these things was he an expert or uniquely gifted. Where he was unique, truly gifted, and truly great was as an explorer, where all his talents were necessary. The most important was his ability as a leader of men. He was born to leadership and reared for it, studied it in his army career, then exercised it on the expedition. How he led is no mystery. His techniques were time-honored. He knew his men. He saw to it that they had dry socks, enough food, sufficient clothing. He pushed them to, but never beyond, the breaking point. He got out of them more than they knew they had to give. His concern for them was that of a father for his son. He was the head of a family. He could lose his temper with them and berate them in front of their fellow soldiers. He could be even sterner. He had a few of them take 50 lashes well laid on. But in the judgment of the enlisted men, he was fair. He didn't make many mistakes. His orders were clear, concise, and correct. Perhaps the finest tribute to his leadership abilities came at the time of the Marias decision. All the men thought the Marias was the river to follow, but they said to Lewis and Clark, very cheerfully, that they were ready to follow us anywhere we thought proper to direct. He shared the work. He cooked for his men and poled a canoe. He was hunter and fisherman. From crossing the Lolo Trail to running the rapids of the Columbia, he never ordered the men to do what he wouldn't do. When it was appropriate, he shared the decision-making. All of it with Clark, of course, but much of it with the men, too, as in deciding where to spend the winter of 1805-6. These are some of the qualities that make for a good company commander. Lewis had them in abundance, plus some special touches that made him a much-loved commander. He had a sense, a feel, for how his family was doing. He knew exactly when to take a break, when to issue a gill, when to push for more, when to encourage, when to inspire, when to tell a joke, when to be tough. He knew how to keep a distance between himself and the men, and just how big it should be. He knew his profession and was proud of it, and one of the very best at it. But if he was a near-perfect army officer, Lewis was a lousy politician. He was entirely unsuited to the job. Jefferson's appointment of Lewis to the governorship was a frightful misjudgment. Jefferson should have found him a post in Washington or Philadelphia and given him some War Department clerks to help with the publication process. As governor, Lewis proved incapable of resisting the temptations of high office, incapable of managing different factions, incapable of compromise. Secretary Bates made some observations that need to be considered, even while discounting the source. Lewis had been in the army too long, just as Bates charged, and was too accustomed to military ways to be a successful governor. Lewis did have a swelled head as a result of the adulation he had received. Lewis did lose his temper too often, also, just as Bates said. He would never have been a successful politician. As a man, he was full of contradictions. He had been a curious, active boy, a hard-drinking, hard-riding army officer, an intensely partisan secretary to the president, an eager explorer, a scientific scholar who paid close attention to detail, a Philadelphia playboy, yet a man who lost Letitia Breckinridge to Robert Gamble, a rich layabout Virginia aristocrat, a life Lewis might have chosen, an overeager governor and speculator in land, a drug taker and an alcoholic. But he was a great company commander, the greatest of all American explorers, and in the top rank of world explorers. Lewis's determination to advance the information of the succeeding generation, the vow he had made on his 31st birthday on the Lemhi Pass in 1805, he fulfilled. Not so completely as he would have liked in the form of the published journals, but his 1805 report from Fort Mandan, along with Clark's map, were printed and widely distributed and had a major impact. His successful voyage was an inspiration in itself. As for information, he had filled in the main outlines of the previously blank map of the northwestern part of the current United States. He may have regarded the expedition as a failure by the time he died. No trade empire had been established or appeared possible any time in his generation. The Indians controlled the Missouri River and were at war with one another. British traders still encroached on American territory. Lewis's glowing reports on the soil and climate in present Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska had not set off a land rush. There was still plenty of land to be had in Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. The State Department was making no effort to claim sovereignty north of the 49th parallel. The government was pressing no claim to the Oregon country. These things would come, but only with the steamship and the railroad. Until they did, the Louisiana Purchase, save for New Orleans, was exactly what Lewis called it in his Indian policy paper, a barren waste. Had Lewis lived, he would have seen steamships and railroads. Lewis's suicide has hurt his reputation. Had Crozat's bullet killed him, he would be honored today far more than he is. Perhaps there would be a river named for him. But through most of the 19th century, he was relatively ignored and in some danger of being forgotten. In 1889 to 91, Henry Adams could write a multi-volume history of the Jefferson administration and scarcely mention Meriwether Lewis or William Clark, whose reputation at that time rested far more on his accomplishments in St. Louis as superintendent of Indian affairs than on the expedition. The publication of the Thwaites edition of the journals at the end of the century began a revival. It has continued, and the reputations of the captains have soared. Today, there are statues to Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Some towns, some counties, many high schools, and numerous streets are named for them. There is a Lewis and Clark College. On July 28, 1805, when he named the Jefferson River, Lewis wrote in his journal that he had done so in honor of that illustrious personage Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States, and the author of our enterprise. In that spirit, it is fitting that Jefferson should get the last word. In his 1813 letter, Jefferson wrote a one-sentence description of Lewis that is as fine a tribute to a subordinate as any President of the United States has ever written. It is impossible to imagine higher praise from a better source. Of courage undaunted, possessing a firmness and perseverance of purpose which nothing but impossibilities could divert from its direction, careful as a father of those committed to his charge, yet steady in the maintenance of order and discipline, intimate with the Indian character, customs, and principles, habituated to the hunting life, guarded by exact observation of the vegetables and animals of his own country, against losing time in the description of objects already possessed, honest, disinterested, liberal, of sound understanding and a fidelity to truth so scrupulous that whatever he should report would be as certain as if seen by ourselves, with all these qualifications as if selected and implanted by nature in one body, for this express purpose, I could have no hesitation in confiding the enterprise to him.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.